And Steve's like, "Watch out, it's kind of slippery right there." And I kind of look up and just wham, just freaking fell flat on my face right in the middle of the river with 100 pounds on my back.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, thank you guys for tuning in. This is episode 94. This is a mid-season episode. So Steve and Lenny just got back from Alaska from their very first caribou hunt, and that is the topic of tonight's discussion. We recorded this one quick before Steve and Lenny and myself are off to chase elk and mule deer and all other critters that we're chasing the rest of September. Hopefully you guys are right in the midst of your season as well, and maybe taking some time to enjoy this episode on the road between hunts. So as I mentioned, tonight's episode is all about Steve and Lenny's Alaskan caribou hunt. We reached out to you guys, our listeners, followers on social media, to inquire about what questions you had or what you wanted to know. We tried to cover as much of that as possible, but I'm sure there's questions you'll still have. So if you do have questions about this episode, about hunting Alaska, about hunting caribou specifically, be sure to reach out. Let us know, podcast@exomountaingear.com, and we will try to tackle those in a future episode if we didn't cover that question on this discussion. Coming up on episode 100, we figured we should do something pretty awesome. And so as a thank you to you guys, we're going to have some great giveaways with episode 100. I'm working on it now. We've reached out to a bunch of our friends and partners and companies. You guys are not going to want to miss this. And there'll be some bonuses for you guys who've already been tuning in, as well as new listeners that we will welcome aboard. But just be sure, stay tuned. Episode 100 is going to be amazing. Between now and then, I know that we're all busy hunting, but we have some amazing episodes that will be coming in the queue as well. So let's get straight to it. This discussion, an amazing adventure that Steve and Lenny had, their first time hunting caribou up in Alaska. Here it is. Steve, Lenny, welcome back. It's just been, gosh, you've been down here in the lower 48 for just a couple days and recovering back from Alaska, so excited that we could sneak this episode in, because I know that you're getting ready to turn around and go on other hunts, as most of us are this time of year. So excited to dive into the story.
Sounds great.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we're excited. It's been, haven't even been home for 48 hours yet. Feels a lot longer, as much work as we've been trying to catch up on.
It's because you haven't slept in the last 48 hours, right?
Yeah, not much.
Cool. So hey, most listeners probably know you guys went up for caribou to Alaska for this trip last year, did moose, this year was caribou. I guess just to get the ball rolling, Lenny, to give us context on kind of, before we get into the story of the hunt, kind of tell us the approach to the hunt. So was it guided? Was it drop? What part of Alaska? Kind of like the big picture context before we dive into the details of the hunt.
Yeah, we worked through Russ Myers with Outdoors International to look. I mean, basically in Alaska, you have to do, you know, there's guided and there's transport services. And so basically we're using what they call a transport service. So it was a little Cessna 180, you know, that gets you back into the backcountry. So first, you know, we worked with Russ and we were really specific. So last time when we did the moose hunt, we went with a much larger operation, I'd say. And we weren't real specific on what we wanted. And so this time we were very specific. We said, all right, we want to be in the mountains. We want to be able to walk around. And, you know, we want like awesome scenery. Like, because after the moose hunt, it was definitely much more about the experience and much less about, you know, killing something up there. So it was basically a drop hunt for, was it 6 days?
Yeah,
it was supposed to be 6 days, ended up being shorter than that because of weather. But yeah, so we booked through that and we found a small transport company. It was basically a husband and a wife and a daughter, and it was a whole different experience, and we can definitely get into.
Yeah, that's cool. So it was drop you off with all of your gear, or did they provide anything?
You have the option, and Steve and I, we chose to basically bring all our own gear. So that makes it a little bit less expensive. And then also, Steve and I, we wanted to be, just kind of stick with what we do and kind of a lightweight, mobile type way of hunting versus, you know, when they give you their gear, it's big, heavy stuff where you're expected to be in a base camp. So we brought all our own gear. Pretty much the only thing they provided was the transportation.
Yeah. So this is skipping ahead, but did you guys end up moving around a bunch, or did you kind of get dropped and stay within that vicinity?
You know, the hunt ended up being a little bit shorter. Otherwise, I'm really sure that we would have moved. But in the end, we ended up staying at the same basically gravel bar strip that we landed at. And that's really for two reasons. One, the trip got cut short because of weather. And two, it basically never gets dark there. So it was literally, it was just light all the time. So
that whole headlamp review that we did was completely pointless for this trip.
You have no idea. You know all those extra batteries we bought for headlamps? Yeah. Didn't need those.
Never turned a headlamp on once.
Really?
Not once.
Kid you not. Like, we went to bed when it was still light outside and woke up when it was light outside. I actually just pulled it up because we never even, like, confirmed when it got dark. But civil twilight was 11:30 p.m. And civil light in the morning was 4:30 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
So basically from 11:30 to 4:30 was like, and it never even got dark. Like, if you got out of the tent in the middle of the night, it's like you could still maybe shoot your bow. It was freaking crazy.
So even lighter than like a clear full moon night, like more light than that?
Yes. Yep.
Wow.
And it jacked Lenny and I up as far as, like, you know, when we first flying up there, we checked, like, wonder what the daylight hours are, and, you know, realized it was pretty long. And we're like, sweet, we're going to be able to hunt freaking, you know, 18 hours of the day. This is going to be awesome. And you realize, like, that's just not practical.
Yeah.
You can't just hunt that much. As optimistic as we were, you just had to sleep. And it was like, you know, when the time changes 1 hour at home, you kind of get jacked up for a week or two. This was like, we were just upside down. We didn't know if it was like 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. at times. It was freaking crazy.
Right. It's like kind of like switching to night shift or vice versa, like trying to go to bed when it's light out or something.
Yeah,
exactly.
It was weird.
Huh. Crazy. Cool. So you guys, I guess let's cover a little bit more kind of on logistics. So you flew into, did you guys fly to Anchorage and then start hopping from there? Or how did that work?
This is pretty simple. Just Boise to Seattle, Seattle to Anchorage, Anchorage to Kotzebue. Kotzebue is your last town. It's basically a kind of a native village that is ridiculous how much government money gets thrown into that stuff, which whole nother conversation. and then from Kotzebue, you jump on the Cessna and basically fly out of there and go land out in, you know, in the middle of nowhere, basically.
Yeah. So, and then obviously with a trip like that, you're for the most part working on a fixed timeline. But as you guys said, things got hairy with weather. What's kind of the big story with that, and how did that change the hunt plans?
Well, so we got in there. So, you know, we leave Boise. I think we left Boise at 8, and we got in Kotzebue about 6 and in the evening. And then so we were supposed to fly out first thing in the morning, and we were actually this transport service first hunters of the year. So we were definitely on the early part of the season. And so, which is kind of nice, because otherwise sometimes if you get stuck in the middle, they're trying to get people out or in, and it can kind of get backed up. So we're excited. We're like, woohoo, first guy's in, no way we're going to get delayed. And of course we wake up in the morning and it's just been 30 mile an hour winds and snow and sleet and fog. And so of course we talk to them and they say, you know, they try to keep it positive. Like, oh, we're going to keep checking the weather. It might break. It might break. But we pretty much knew, like, yeah, we're screwed. We're going to lose a whole day. And so we kind of waited around the whole day for the weather to clear. And he had contact with a guide out in the field, you know, because we're flying, I think, 150 miles north. And so there's no, like, super clear way for them to know exactly what the weather is. And so this other guide kept calling in and kind of telling them that it was socked in and we couldn't get in there. So but then our hotel, obviously Kotzebue's not very big. There's one really nice hotel there, and the rest of it is, I mean, it's pretty, I don't know if it's poverty stricken or what it is, but it's rough, wouldn't you say, Steve?
Yeah. It's a light way to put it. We got some photos. We'll put a post up or something. It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah. It's nothing that you'd see. Yeah. It was crazy. But so we went over to our transport service, and they really went above and beyond. They fed us dinner that night in their house, and then it was more or less kind of a shipping container. They said, "Well,
their
you
house
guys
was?
Can stay here." No,
oh,
well, their
I was
house.
Like, what?
their house wasn't that nice.
it's nothing's nice up there. It's crazy. It's just stepping into like a third world when you fly into those villages.
Yeah,
it literally is.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I think our transport guy, he said, he mentioned that I think there was some government housing built up there, and he said it was $800 a foot to build it.
What?
And you know, it's nothing fancy. It's just, it's crazy. I mean, there's no labor. It's up in the middle of nowhere. It's just crazy.
Wow.
So we ended up spending just, you know, throwing our air mattress and sleeping bags in a shipping container, basically. And I'd bought, kind of funny part of the story, I'd bought this little cribbage game from REI, like a little one. And Steve and I had never played cribbage. So we're like, yeah, all right. You know, we're going to play some cribbage. We're stuck here. Let's figure this out. He and I are flipping through the stupid. Have you ever played cribbage, Mark?
No, I was just thinking you guys sound like two old ladies playing bridge or something, though. I'm like, what are you guys talking about?
Yeah, so it's got like two pages of directions, and Steve and I get about, you know, one paragraph in, are like, whoa, this is way ahead.
Let's make up our rules.
I was a couple whiskeys deep at that point as well.
Yeah. And, you know, it's light and there's nothing to do. We'd walk the whole town back and forth, you know, a couple of times. There's nothing to do. So fortunately, our Mike, our transport guy, he came in and he was a character. And he came in there and just totally just schooled us, like taught us how to play cribbage. But we're drinking and playing cribbage. And it was actually a lot of fun.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. So it was real personal, you know, with those guys there. In the morning we had breakfast with them, and again the weather was pretty bad, but finally we ended up getting out of there what, maybe 10 o'clock?
It was like 11, I think, just after 11 when we finally left. Yeah,
so finally the weather cleared enough at about 11, and we jumped on his little Cessna 180 and threw everything in and head north.
So what, for the Cessna 180, what's the gear limit that you guys had to deal with?
They were really, they were super conservative. We had 120 pounds of gear that we could take.
Not
including your weapon. Yeah, so it's a lot of gear. Frankly, it's crazy how fast you fill that up.
Right.
I'm sure we'll go through gear here at some point, but it's that weight adds up faster than you think. You can go backpacking with 30 pounds, and you think you'd be able to do that, but yeah, Alaska's just a different beast.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot more contingencies and things like that.
Yeah.
So getting on the Cessna, the flight in, had decent weather then? Ended up going okay?
Yeah, it was awesome. So we're supposed to head up, like, you can take two routes in there. One over the mountains if it's good, clear visibility, and one kind of around the mountains through the valleys to get back in there. And luckily, like, halfway out, you know, Mike looks over the pilot and says, oh, man, I can see you over the mountains. And basically just hard right turns, and we just start heading over the mountains. And that flight alone, Lenny and I both got off the plane and we're like, we could turn around and go home right now and be like totally content. Like, you were flying just through the most beautiful country, literally flying over muskox, moose, grizzly bears, caribou. Like, you're pretty low to the ground. You could see everything extremely well. I mean, I think Lenny and I were both just like jaw dropped the whole time in. You know, it was just unbelievably beautiful up there. It was just freaking gorgeous. Yeah, the muskox, I think, for me, was the coolest part. You know, it's an animal I've never seen a grizzly either, but that part was freaking sweet. So we fly in there and then basically land a camp. One thing I'll tell anybody, which we've made the mistake twice now, is when your pilot tells you where you're going to land, just ask him to do like an extra circle or two and get a really good lay of the land. You know, our first moose hunt was completely flat. So once you were down there on the ground, you were basically lost. And then this one, we had some terrain to kind of get up, but still having like an aerial picture, maybe even take some photos out the window of the plane.
Definitely.
That stuff it's invaluable. Cause even when we were flying out, I was looking down and noticing caribou trails and stuff that had we known were there, we may have hunted a little bit differently. So it's definitely, I think, a good tip to follow.
Yeah. Like you said, that's invaluable. I mean, it's, you know, a little scouting before you drop, essentially.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, and these pilots, you know, they're very much like point A, point B, drop you off, get back. You know, I mean, it's their job, so they're not, there's not much leisure in there unless you push it. So you definitely have to be like, all right, show me where it is. Let's do one loop. And I'm sure they'd do it if you asked them, but otherwise they're just straight in, straight down, and then they're out of there.
Yeah. So with caribou being migratory and just things in general, like with this transport service, is it pretty much predetermined where he's taking you? Is he kind of getting any reports from the field on like, okay, let's go to option B because of this? I mean, how does that work? Or do you even fully know?
We don't fully know.
Yeah.
I mean, you're told initially like, hey, we're following the herds, we're talking to people, we're flying all the time. And that's the truth. They're making 2-3 trips a day, so they see where the caribou are. And so that's what everybody tells you, is that you're going to get put like right where the caribou are at that point in time. But the truth of the matter is, unless you're flying in like a Super Cub, there's, you know, Cessnas are, they're not big planes, but they can't land anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much, I think all those transport service and guides, they've got certain areas where they know they can land with right. whatever the wind's doing, the weather's doing. So in a way you're somewhat pigeonholed.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We tried to get an answer out of them beforehand of like where we're going to be. And so we could download maps and make sure we're all dialed in that way. And they basically said, well, we don't know. We just don't know until we fly out into the field. And I think there's some truth to that, but I think they also have a very like a predetermined spot. Like, okay, if everything is looking good, then we're going to go here. So, yeah, flat out don't know. I'm sure as you're, you know, we're the very first hunters. Mike told us on the flight out it was his first flight back in that country, although he'd talked to other pilots and then there's some guides. There's a guide maybe it's 20 miles away that we flew over their camp, and he pointed out that was the guy he was talking to. And so that guy had been in and out of there. They were on they had a grizzly bear camp set up. And so he'd been talking to them. So they kind of had an idea. I think all those guys have communication back and forth with each other of what the caribou are doing and what's going on. So I doubt he would have dropped us at that airport or that landing strip had there not been any caribou around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also our transport service, he'd been up in Kotzebue for 35 years. So yeah, yeah. He pretty much knew what, I mean, I think he knew everything in that whole range. Mm. So yeah. that made us feel a lot more confident, I guess.
Yeah. Right. I will say that was flying with Mike was awesome. 'Cause the first time, you know, it was a bigger company and they had tons of different pilots coming in and out, and you didn't really, you like get in the plane, like, how long have you been flying? You know, hope the answer is longer than 3 months.
Yeah.
with Mike, it was awesome. He's been up there forever, and just a super crazy experienced pilot. And take any kind of nerves you have about flying a little plane out, like, almost immediately.
Yeah. That's good. Cool. So wheels hit the ground, drop you off. He takes off. Game, it's time to go.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, how do you even like? I mean, because you're dropped off. Yeah. You didn't, like you just said, you didn't have maps. You didn't get to scout this area. You're hunting a new species. I mean,
right.
Like what's going through your head? What's happening?
It's kind of intimidating, right? I mean, cause especially, you know, the frustrating part is basically we were out in the field, I guess, for 6 nights, 7 days. But only 5 of that you can hunt, right? I mean, the day you get dropped off, you can't hunt the day you fly, and the day you get picked up, you know, unless you kill something in camp, you're really, you know, you don't know if we got picked up pretty early in the morning, so it'd have been tough to kill something that morning and get everything packed back to camp. So on a 5-day hunt, we lose a day right off the get-go. So we're down to a 4-day hunt, and Lenny and I both, you know, we filmed this entire hunt, so we were alternating cameraman shooter. So each of us got 2 days. Basically to learn a new animal, learn how to hunt them, learn, you know, everything, learn the country and get something killed. It's kind of a, you know, a daunting task for sure. I mean, I think I saw some of the Instagram comments about what's one thing you'd change. And I think rifle hunting caribou, no problem. 5 days is plenty. Bow hunting caribou, I think, especially if you went early, like we did, where the migration wasn't going like crazy. I think you'd want a few extra days in there. 'Cause it's, as we kind of learned, it's a numbers game. Just flat out, you need a lot of caribou to pass by you in order to get an opportunity at a good bull, because there's so much out of your control. It's not like here in Idaho where, you know, you glass a big buck, you stalk them, you blow it, you can just go hike over the next ridge and find the next one. You know, you're just so handicapped that it's just a different way of hunting, and you're really at the mercy of what is presented to you.
Yeah, I mean, even if you saw some animals like 2-3 miles away, if they're going like slightly away from you, you'll never catch them. Mm-hmm. Or like first thing in the second morning, there's a big bull and he got past camp, but I still really want to kill something with my bow. Once he got past us and was going the other way, it's like, you just have to give up, you know, versus an elk or a deer. It's like, all right, I know he's going to go over the hill. He's going to bed down. I'll be able to catch up to him. These, they're gone. I mean, they're 10 miles away and, you know, in an hour. So it's a lot less in your control.
Mm-hmm. So is the general strategy then to spot them, figure out where they're going and try to beat them to it and kind of make kind of a, like an ambush style, like catch them as they're coming type move?
Exactly.
Yeah, basically. And Mike, our pilot, told us, you know, hey, like he dropped us off and he basically said, you know, you need to get high or as high as you can. I mean, we were right on the edge of the Brooks Range, literally like walk 100 yards and you start hitting the hills and you could climb up into it. But all the caribou were out in the valley, basically to the south of us. And so you just get like on a 100-foot knob, and we just spent that. We basically set up camp on day one, can't hunt. So we just got up on that knob and glassed, basically, you know, we didn't make it till dark, 'cause it never got dark. at least not while we could stay awake. But glassed and just started looking for caribou. And one thing that was crazy up there that blew Lenny and I away was the visibility. Like you could glass caribou at 4 or 5 miles easy, even through your binos.
Really?
It was crazy. Just the air is so clear and the atmospheric conditions are so perfect that it's nothing like we've ever experienced in Idaho. You just can't see, you know, 2-3 miles is a stretch. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Distortion, right. And waves, and there'd be a little heat waves here and there, but nothing like I've ever, it was crazy. I remember just like not sure how far something was. We'd glass some caribou and be like, hey, that doesn't look that far away. And then like pull up our Earthmate cell phone app, you know, and like do the little scale bar and like, holy crap, that is 3.5 miles away. So wow. That part of it was crazy. But basically that first night got high and just started, you know, paying attention to where the caribou were. Everyone told us, Mike told us, all the research we did was like, they're basically like, they're on migration trails for the most part. And they're, you know, one caribou will pass through there, or a herd will, give it a couple hours, another herd will go right through the exact same spot. And I say as a general rule, that was the truth. You know, the things changed during the course of it. We had crazy weather come in and they kind of changed their route a little bit. But in general, they're all on the same path. And for the most part, unfortunately, that path was 3 miles south of us.
Yeah. When you say like a herd comes through and then maybe another herd and, you know, we're tossing that phrase around of herd, but what kind of sizes are we talking? And I know it varies, but what were you guys seeing in terms of a group?
15 to 20.
Okay.
Yeah. I say all over the, I mean, everything from just a cow and a calf. We'd see some lone cows every once in a while, but in general, yeah, 15 to 20. We didn't see any huge groups, which I think if you went, you know, middle of September, you probably would.
Yeah. These are like more pockets of, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So like
yeah,
if 15, you see 15 to 20, what is there? 3, 2, 3, 4 bulls in there? Or
that's the part that blew us away. I mean, so we guessed, total guess that we saw 800 caribou on the trip. Uh-huh. And on Mike, when he picked us up on the way out, was asking how many caribou we'd seen. We're like, you know, maybe 800, kind of figuring. You know, it's not like we're counting, you're seeing so many of them.
Yeah.
But he said on a good day, 1,000 caribou a day will move through that country. And we're just like, holy crap.
Wow.
Because we can't imagine that. Which those are kind of numbers I think for bow hunting you would need for that style of hunt that we were doing anyways. The crazy thing is out of all those caribou, we saw 4 what we, you know, kind of deemed mature bulls. So that our bull to cow ratio was
for
very,
the
very
whole trip,
the entire trip, we saw 4 bulls. And the crazy part about that is we watched 2 of them get killed by guys with rifles, like just right in front of our eyes. We literally like watched the guy with the rifle set up and
really
freaking dropped.
Yeah. We were literally waiting for them to cross after we'd hiked 3 miles, finally saw them come over the ridge. And yeah.
How far were those guys?
They were camped like probably 3 to 4 miles south of us. Well, no, at least 3.5 to 4, because they had, you know, we were 3-ish miles and they had hiked up towards us. And so, yeah, we talked to the, you know, the service on the way out, and they said, as a general rule, you know, from one air transport service to another, they try to always keep camps 5 miles apart. These guys just got dropped off a little close to us, and most guys aren't like hiking 3 miles across the tundra like we were, you know, but that's just where the caribou were. So we were willing to do whatever. You know, we had some at camp, just not, it was like, you know, 10 to 1, the amount of caribou that moved through that country south of us versus at camp. And so we made the trek almost every single day except for Saturday when the weather hit us.
So when you say you wanted those big numbers, you need those big numbers if you're hunting archery, what is it about, like, say you know what they're moving through, you get to a point and you have a herd moving through or a group moving through, what is it where you need these high numbers that makes the shot opportunities difficult? Is it that, you know, just they're moving through quick, you can't get a shot? Is it that they're spooking? Like, what is it with these high numbers of caribou that you actually need that many to get a good encounter? Or is it just that bull ratio? I mean,
yeah, I'd say it's kind of all the above. I mean, the lack, I mean, I don't know if later in the season the bull ratio is a lot higher, but yeah, one, we just needed more bulls coming through. And then it's kind of like you have one shot versus, you know, an elk or a deer, you know, you might kind of get close and back up, and these ones, they're always moving. So for one, you got to figure out where they're crossing. I mean, first, they've got to come, you've got to get the big bull, you got to figure out where they're crossing, and then they've got to cross, you know, with the bow right at that right spot, because there's not a whole lot of opportunity to you know, reposition yourself. So inevitably, you know, where you think they're going to cross, they end up crossing at 75 or 100 yards rather than at 40 or 50. And Steve and I, we did this, like, we practice all the time because we're like, well, let's see how this works out. So we found this good crossing and it'd be all cows. And so we'd hurry and sneak down there, and inevitably, you know, one would kind of go downwind of us, and then it would kind of blow up, and then the other ones would kind of scurry at 100 yards. And so even on those cows, I mean, we didn't have perfect opportunities by any means.
Just
messing around.
And you probably, I mean, so where you're at, I'm assuming you don't have a ton of cover to work with, just minor terrain features and that.
Yeah,
willows.
Yeah, your best bet would be a river crossing for bow hunting. A river crossing where there's going to be willows on both sides, and you could set up in the willows and wait for them to come across. For us, that wasn't really an option where they were crossing, but we had some terrain features where we actually kind of sat up on this little knob that was like 30 feet tall. And then behind us, they went through this, or kind of the side of us, they came across this little thing, went through a saddle and dropped down. And there was this kind of just 10-foot rock that we could, cliffy rock that we could sit behind. And so we did it 3 or 4 times. They'd cross, we'd run around to that rock and set up. And then, you know, it was always just cows and calves coming through. And that's where we just, you just needed the numbers, because the lack of bulls that we were seeing, you know, you really would need 1,000 a day. And eventually a bull's going to come across. But you said it's not, like Lenny said, it's not, you just, it's so different. They're migrating. They're on that tundra. There's no way you can keep up with them and get a shot. It's too open, you know. It's basically, you got that one chance when they cross, and if you don't hit it right, and then you're SOL. And another big issue we had was, pretty much we probably averaged 20-mile-an-hour winds the entire trip.
Wow.
I mean, it was... the first day we got there wasn't bad on Wednesday. Thursday and Friday was just steady 20 miles an hour, just all day long, all day, all night, and then like 30 mile an hour gusts. Then Saturday we woke up, and we actually spent the entire day in camp Saturday because they were like 30 to 40 mile an hour winds. I mean, you couldn't, there's just nothing you could do. You couldn't, there's no way you could draw a bow and hold it in that condition. And it was probably with the wind chill, you know, single digits, if not, you know, zero. Yeah, it was freaking cold. So that was, you know, that was definitely, Alaska kind of gave us her, gave us a pretty good shot of bad weather on our part, you know?
Yeah. So going back to the bow hunting and these caribou moving through, are there any strategies for, like, say, you know, say herd does come through and you finally get a decent bull coming through. Is there any stopping him, any strategy for that? Or you pretty much just have to make that shot opportunity happen because he's, you know, he's migrating, he's on the move?
you know, I think Steve, you try to make some sounds to see if it would stop them.
They looked at me. Some cows looked at me like, or two of them were walking together and they were like 50 yards. And I was just, I drew just, you know, seeing if I could hold on them in the wind. And, I mean, one just kept walking and one just looked at me for a second and kept moving on. So one thing that was crazy was the caribou. They just don't, the cows and calves could care less about you. I mean, they would kind of skirt you at 100 yards, but you could literally like just walk up to them. It was absolutely crazy. I actually talked to Brian Barney, who've had on the podcast before, because he had just got back from a caribou hunt. And that's one thing he told me is like, man, up to 200 yards, they don't care. You could just stand up and walk straight at them. And then once you get to that 200 yard mark, then they're a little bit more cautious, at least the cows and the calves. We didn't get to practice that on any mature bulls. I'm sure they're a little bit more weary.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And when we mean don't care, it's not like they lift up and they're watching you. Like literally they will not even look at you until you get to that. I'd even say closer, like for us, I mean, 100 yards because it's super windy. So they couldn't hear anything. And I mean, until you got within 100 yards, they almost didn't even care.
Hmm. Yeah. It was crazy. It's like you'd think they didn't have any predators up there, but we saw plenty of grizzly bears and we know there's wolves. And I don't know. Another thing too is they are migrating and they're moving. So if you're hunting them in the future, don't be afraid to move and let like the cows that already passed see you, because it doesn't matter. They're going to keep going, and then the group that's behind them is going to go through the exact same spot. So it's definitely, you could be super aggressive and get away with just so much more than we ever could with a mule deer or an elk.
Yeah, which is kind of fun, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's a much more active, engaged hunt.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of like, like you said, I mean, it's like, oh, crap, we're going to blow these out of the basin. They're freaking leaving anyway, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah, it's... they're freaking trucking and they're just going to keep passing you by, and you just keep playing it smart. And I think eventually if you're trying to get it done with a bow, you know, you'll get your opportunity if you have the numbers there passing in front of you. So at least on our hunt, I think if you go a little earlier where they're like more just milling around, maybe stalking's an option. But for us, you know, they literally just on their feet. Every once in a while, they kind of mill around and you see like one or two bed down. And it'd be like 5-10 minutes, and then they'd get up and keep moving. So there was basically just, you know, your only option was get in front of them and have them come by you.
Hmm. So before we get to where you guys found some success, anything else that stands out that we would skip in these first few days here?
If you and your hunting buddy have the same color pack, make sure you don't wear the same pair of pants and shirt when you go to the airport.
Oh, it's so cute.
That's exactly what our flight attendant said.
Oh my gosh.
We had both like tan colored Prada pants on, and we had like Exo shirts that were green, and then we had both had Ranger green packs in the airport.
Oh my gosh. So not only the same colors, you're like wearing the same logo. Oh, you guys are total, like, you know.
Yeah.
What are you guys, own the brutal company or something? You guys are ridiculous.
The lady on the plane, like the stewardess was, or flight attendant was like, looked at us and was like, are you guys intentionally looking the same? And now she was the third person to say that. And we're just like, son of a bitch.
Well, she was like the third person to say it, but it probably like 4,000 people thought it and don't say it, absolutely. You know, especially if you're going through Seattle and when you're down in the big airports.
Yeah. So that was just in Boise and on the Boise flight to Seattle. So in Seattle, I literally like, all right, I'm throwing a different freaking shirt on. Yeah. So I changed my shirt in Seattle just so I didn't have to hear that comment again. It was brutal.
It's funny, if you look at my dresser, it's literally like a stack of Prana pants and shorts, and then a stack of like Exo shirts that, you know, steal
the uniform.
So it's pretty much, that's it.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
No, other than that, it was getting out there, you know, we'll dive into gear here, you know, getting that dialed in. I think we had a lot of we learned a lot from our moose hunt. We learned the right questions to ask. We learned the gear to bring. And then I think more than anything, we learned the right expectations, you know, 'cause that moose hunt was pretty expensive. And this was, the caribou hunt was about half the price. And for us to spend, I mean, we're just so used to buying $25-$35 tags here in Idaho and just driving and hunting, and you do whatever you want. If the weather's bad, you leave or whatever. To go up there and you spend that money, you're expecting everything. You just, you know, you're expecting everything to, like, go perfect. So you have this dream of this amazing Alaska. And the reality is, Alaska is a lot harsher than what we have here in the lower 48. And you're going to have bad weather, and you're going to have delays, and you may not have great hunting. So it's definitely something I think you need to go into the hunt expecting adversity, and just be ready for that. Have the right mindset. Because I think on our moose hunt, you know, we were just, you know, we had this fantasy of an Alaska hunt in our head, and you kind of got kicked in the nuts and slapped in the face with reality. And going into this hunt, we had much, you know, I don't want to say lower expectations, but just realistic expectations of what to expect. And, you know, spending a day and a half in Kotzebue just sitting on your thumbs, you know, the first time we'd done that, we'd have been really pissed off. And this time you're anxious, but you understand, like, there's just nothing you can do. You're just at the mercy of the elements waiting to get in the field. And then
Right. Once
we're in the field and the caribou hunting's a little slow, you know, it was just kind of like, well, this is what it is. And Lenny kind of, we just both just, you know, heck, let's just, we're here. The country's beautiful. Let's sit back and relax. And, you know, you like Saturday that we spent the entire day in camp, you know, just freaking one day within 100-yard radius. You know, it's nothing we would ever even think of as possible here in Idaho. It's you just kind of accept it and deal with it.
Yeah.
And stop whining. You know, we were kind of whiny bitches on our first trip, and this one, you just realize what's you know, what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, man, that's so true, because your perspective is your reality. So how you choose to look at it is how you're going to experience it. You know, and like being stuck back and not catching that transport flight, you know, it could ruin it if you want to let it ruin it. Or like you were saying, Lenny, you could have a good time, like enjoy the company of Mike, you know, throw back a whiskey, play the game, and heck, man, we're freaking in Alaska. Like, what are you gonna do? You know, like, just, you have to choose to enjoy it. That's in a major way, it is a choice. So expectations are always huge, especially traveling, you know, for a hunt like that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Since you mentioned it, what is you know, we don't need to go into like a breakdown of each step, but what's a ballpark to make something like this happen for, you know, your average guy in the lower 48?
You know, I think our hunt, you could have, we probably spent a little bit more than this, because when we were stuck in Kotzebue, we went out to dinner a few times and lunch, and we did stay in the nice hotel they have there.
Don't
they
include
have,
all that pampering crap that you guys do, just like right. The basic hunting stuff.
I think you could do it for under $4,000.
Okay.
With flights, the transport service, your tags, flights, and miscellaneous, you know, there's going to be costs that pop up, getting the meat home, stuff like that. I think you can do that for under $4,000.
Okay.
We were probably like $4,500 each.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. And that doesn't include the matching outfits, right?
No.
Company issue.
Yeah, company issue. There you go. The uniform. Okay. So I'm assuming, based on what I'm hearing, because I know you guys, you know, got caribou later in the trip. This was after Saturday. Then was this on Sunday that you guys ended up finding some success?
Was it Sunday? Yeah, it was Sunday. Yeah, we flew out Monday. Yeah. But before that, we really only had one bow opportunity at a small bull. So that was on Friday, right? When was that? I was hunting. So that was Thursday.
Oh, the small bull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one that had
yeah.
big times and tines and no palms.
Oh, yeah. The river one.
Yeah.
That was badass.
Yeah.
That was cool. Story on that.
Oh. Well, Steve, he had the better perspective on it. And yeah, I was actually being a little bit of a downer then. So those guys had just shot that bull in front of us. We'd been sitting there all day. I'm talking like 10 hours. Finally, big bull comes over, and these guys shoot the bull literally half a mile from us. And we're sitting there with our bows, you know, like idiots, like, yeah, that's real useful. And now it's just pissed. And kind of, I was being a little bit whiny then, actually. And I'm like, goddamn stupid, you know, fly 150 miles and there's a camp 3 miles away. Like, you know, I had a little moment there where I kind of digressed a little bit. But Steve's like, hey, man, that one, they kind of, when they shot him, they kind of pushed some caribou kind of exactly where we thought they were going to come, more or less. And we kind of skirted down this little ridge a little bit. And so he was like, dude, get down there, get down there. I think they're going to cross that river. And I was like, all right. You know, and I was still kind of pissed. And so, but I hauled butt and I got, and this is how you're going to kill them with a bow. I firmly believe I ran down, stood next to the willows, and they're pretty tall. So I couldn't quite see up there what they were doing. And, but I was looking back at Steve and he was saying, you know, stay there, stay there, stay there. And I looked down the river, I don't know, 100 yards.
More than that. Yeah, they're everybody there. It was a 200 yard sprint for you at least. Lenny set a world record for sprinting on tundra.
Yeah, so they go crossing, a couple hundred yards below us. I look at him and he's like, stay there, stay there. So I'm staying there. And then another, like, I don't know, 10 go across, another 5 go across. He's like, stay there. And then all of a sudden he's just like, go, 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 go. And I'm like, oh crap. And I do not recommend this, like, arrow knocked full on 200 yard sprint down the side of the river. Like, I could see their horns. They were running too on the other side. And I'm full on dead sprint running down this thing. And I actually caught them. But unfortunately, the willows kind of, you know, weren't very tall right there. And they got partway across the river and they saw me. And then they're kind of like, eh, that doesn't look right. And they actually backed up, went down the river a little bit more. And I ran down again. But when they went across the river, they kind of angled away from me. And I'm like full on, like, can't breathe. I'm like, and I'm trying to range them. And they come out at 55 yards and I draw. And they didn't give me an opportunity. But
yeah. No, it was. It was one thing we learned from that, and I was kicking myself because the caribou were like schizo, because they were literally like, you feed and then just the whole herd will sprint for 300 yards and then stop, and then they'll turn 90 degrees and feed 20 yards and then sprint back 50 yards. I mean, they're literally, you know, like, you've seen antelope kind of, we compared them a lot to antelope because antelope just seemed totally random at times, and these caribou were like exponentially crazier than that. And so all of them were together, the bulls with all these cows, probably like 15, 20 cows. And then there was 3 or 4 bulls and they're coming towards the river. And then all the cows just start going in a dead sprint down the river and the bulls stay there. And Lenny could see the cows and then they start crossing. And he's looking at me and I'm like, you know, putting my arms up in the air, stop, stop, stop. And then one of the little bulls kind of goes like halfway down towards the cows. And I'm just like, but the bull that we wanted Lenny to shoot was like just directly across the river, probably 70 yards away from Lenny, but across, you know, willows, you can't shoot. So that little bull literally sprints back to the big bull and then all four of them just start hauling ass down the bank. I mean, it's just like the most random thing you've ever seen. And then, so yeah, then I'm flagging Lenny to haul ass down there. But I think it's, everyone had told us this and I should have signaled Lenny to get down there. If they have a crossing point, they're all going to cross at that same point. So I think keep that in mind if you ever, you know, if you're seeing some, which we had already known, but it was just weird to me that the bull was just hanging out by the willows. And I thought maybe he'd cross somewhere different. But if they have a point where they're all going to cross, I think they're all going to do that. And Lenny would have killed that bull had he gone down to that. The second he saw the cows, then that bull would have probably walked by him at 20 yards. So we were kicking ourselves, you know, hindsight on that one and something. You know, sometimes you just got to experience that stuff. And just like we have with mule deer and elk, a lot of times learn what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. And your second go around, you're going to kill one.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a pretty cool. I got the whole sequence on video. It was freaking awesome.
Yeah. We had a good laugh about it. Man, yeah. I haven't ran that fast in a long time.
Yeah. I'm waiting for just like a short clip, maybe even sped up a little bit of Lenny just like hauling it down this tundra riverside.
It's funny because it looks like it's a race because you can see them on the other side of the river and we're just like paralleling each other, just running down the river.
Yeah, this is going to be good. Awesome. Oh, cool. So let's jump to Sunday then. So did you guys, going into Sunday, coming off of Saturday, the crazy winds late in the trip, the last Sunday would have been your last full day to hunt, right?
Yep. Yep.
So going into that, did you plan on, like, from the beginning picking up a rifle, or what was the thoughts Sunday morning?
Yeah, it was definitely, if we need to, let's pick up the rifle. I mean, we wanted to try really hard with our bows. But, you know, it's a last day and, you know, we get up on this glass and knob from camp and you know, you could see 5 miles, and immediately you knew, like, you know, the first day or two, it's like group of 20, group of 20, group of 20, group of 20. It's like, man, all right, this is going to be fun for 4 hours, because it'd literally be like half hour, 20 to come through. Well, here comes the next 20. And instead, we look out there and it's like, all right, there's five, there's five. And so we pretty much knew that, I mean, we brought the bow, but I pretty much knew we were going to shoot some with a rifle just because the opportunity was so low.
Yeah, Lenny, we had the discussion, and Lenny grabbed the bow, and I was like, oh, dude, I'll throw the rifle in my pack. If we know it's not going to happen with the bow, I'll get you the rifle really quick, and then you can shoot them, and, you know, we'll be done. So that was definitely the plan. And anyway, so it was like the mindset was, okay, it's last day. Saturday, we saw, you know, we went from seeing 200 to 300 caribou down to like maybe 50 on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So we knew, like, we had the feeling that the migration was like, we're seeing a gap in it. And so we knew going into Sunday morning, you know, what is our best chance to kill a caribou tomorrow? You know, we're up here. We need to get at least one on the ground. And we both, you know, like, hey, all right, where we've been 3 miles south, you know, hiking to is consistently seeing the most. So that's where we need to be the next morning. And so that was basically the plan. I think we woke up, glassed, from our little glassing point for maybe half an hour, made some coffee, kind of made sure there wasn't any caribou really close to camp, and then made our trek across the tundra. Once we got down there, we went to our first little knob that was the river crossing spot that we had played with. And then trying to remember, I think we were just, yeah, no, we were we there, Lenny, when we saw the bull? Yeah, we were.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it wasn't after about half an hour of glassing, we saw the bull, Lenny ends up shooting. It was just one small group of 10, 15 caribou with this small bull in it. And then so we made it to the next knob, which is where I filmed Lenny running up and down the river. and we were kind of, we hadn't actually crossed that river yet. There's another river right by camp that we had to cross. And it was kind of a bigger river. It was a little like intimidating because we're talking like, you know, crossing the little river, like, man, if you fell in, like, A, this is like Arctic freezing cold water. B, you got 20, 30 mile an hour winds. C, it's 30 degrees outside. Like, that's not a good situation to be in.
Do you guys just have hip waders?
Yeah. Yeah, just hip waders. I think, man, I don't know. We have these ones called Neos River Trekkers, and they are awesome, bomb-proof. But every single trip, moose trip now and caribou trip, we've had issues with, you got to wade across something and they go over the top of your hip waders. And so it's, I almost wish we had like full on waders, but then that gets complicated because then you have to pack like boots with them or they're going to be a lot heavier and bulkier. And, I don't know what the answer is there, but it's, the hip waders have been, they're great until you get too deep and then you're SOL.
Right.
I guess Lenny can tell a story from here once we spot his bowl.
Yeah, so we spot this bull, and it's literally coming through the same draw where we saw those other two bulls get killed. And it was kind of like, well, do we stay on our side of the river? We jump to their side of the river, and we decided to jump to their side of the river. And it took us a little while to get across it, because like Steve said, it was, you know, another little bit deeper. We could not have crossed it. And, you know, we got our packs on, we get across there. And right when we got across, I mean, they covered a half a mile.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably at least a half a mile. And so, man, as soon as you get across, I kind of look through the willows, and I'm like, man, they're right there. They're coming. And, you know, a little bit of luck for sure. They could have went, you know, one way or the other, but they kind of came right towards us. And at that point, I think I still had my bow. And then I was like, oh, man, just give me the rifle, because we just weren't set up good, and I didn't know where they were going to go. And grabbed the rifle, snuck out there, and they just kind of wandered into about, I think it's like 180 yards, broadside with Steve's 270. And, you know, it's funny, these Arctic animals – it's weird. They're not like a deer or elk, man. You shoot them, and they just—it's weird. They don't run like a deer and elk would. Mm-hmm. It literally just ran like 10 yards, kind of stopped. I shot him again, and then he just kind of like literally kind of ran in a circle for a little bit, and died.
Which is the same thing, because we watched two other bulls get killed, and they did the exact same thing.
Yeah, they did the exact same thing. Yeah, it's just like they're just kind of programmed just to kind of take it. They don't have like that, like a crazy like flight, like got to run away. It was really weird. So, you know, that's the first thing I've killed with a rifle in, 10, 12 years. But it was actually a lot of fun. And so I had fun doing it and had no regrets. And he wasn't the biggest bull we saw, but I think he was probably the fifth biggest.
Yeah, for sure.
I think he was the fifth biggest bull we saw up there. So it's not like he was, you know, tiny. Right. And of course we'd seen grizzly right there too. So Steve and I are like, bear spray, 40s, you know, put our handguns out. Like, it was good.
Yeah, we literally like surrounded the carcass with like bear spray pistol,
so all accessible.
And gun. That way, because we were like probably 80 yards from the willows or something. A grizzly could come to 80 yards, right. And the wind was blowing directly into the willows. And yeah, we had seen three grizzlies right in that area like every single day.
We knew those other carcasses were just happening.
The other carcasses were right there.
So you're...
And we've just got no experience with that, right? So it's like, you don't know, is this an issue or is there no way in hell a grizzly's gonna like smell that and come in and charge? Or they smell the humans. And one thing we did see was we were watching a grizzly through the spawn scope one day and it just stood up, you could tell a smell in the air, and then just hauled ass the other way. And that made us feel like a little bit more confident that we were pretty sure those other hunters were somewhere right there that we couldn't see, and he smelled them and got out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, that's good. So you're, what would you say, three and a half in this area?
Three and a half. Yeah, I haven't Google Earth. That Earthmate's not the most precise thing, but it was like roughly 3.5 miles of tundra, which is 6, 7, 8 miles. I mean, to throw a number at it, it's a hell of a lot harder than walking on solid ground, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, where do you go from here? Were you guys packing back? How did it? Because I know in the end, like, this is also the same day you punched a tag, Steve. So where do things go from here as you're on full grizzly duty and getting this getting Lenny's bull taken care of?
Well, a couple things I want to say. It was just really cool. You know, I've never seen one of those animals on the ground. So the very first thing, you know, you walk up to it. They're just a little bit bigger than a big mule deer buck, is my opinion. They're much closer to a deer than an elk. So size-wise, they're probably a little smaller than what I expected. And, of course, my bull wasn't a big mature bull, so maybe a big mature bull is a lot bigger. But, you know, mine was probably just 20% bigger than a big mule deer buck. And then the other crazy thing is their fur is like this crazy soft, like it feels like you're like petting a rabbit.
Huh.
Like nothing you would ever think. It was crazy. Like, you know, so it's super thick and super soft.
Yeah. We were sitting there just like petting it for 5 minutes, just like tripping out. it was absolutely beautiful. Like had a little white mane and one of the most beautiful animals I've ever seen on the ground. It was one of those where like you don't want to take the knife and start skinning it up, you know, because it was just a freaking gorgeous animal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did, went ahead and broke him down, but up in Alaska, and actually specifically in this unit, you're actually required to take the rib cage on the bone.
On the bone?
On the bone,
Yeah. So you could saw it off on each side of the spine, but you had to leave the ribs on the bone, which was you know, something we'd never had to done before, for sure.
Right.
Yeah. So we got them all cleaned up, and then one thing the guide said, he's like, you know, don't get your pack super bloody and leave them in camp. He's like, you know, that'll just invite bears. So we're kind of looking at this thing like, oh, what do we do? So, you know, we had our new dry bag inserts and we're like, well, shoot, man, it was cold. I mean, it's super cold up there. Steve actually had to stop cleaning for a while because his hands were so frozen. And we're like, well, hey, let's just drop these dry bags and, you know, strap them to the frame and hike back. And that actually worked really, really good. Kept our packs completely, you know, blood free, you know, drop two hinds and back straps in one and, you know, and two shoulders and rib cages in the other and packed out with it. Worked really good.
Somehow I got the miscellaneous meat bag too.
Yes, you did.
He's like, my pack's going to be heavier. You take the miscellaneous. I'm like, oh, whatever. And like halfway through the hike back to camp, we stopped and set down the packs and I picked mine up. I'm like, son of a, this is, you know, I bet it was like 115 pounds is total guess, but
yeah,
I'm like, I'll pick up Lenny's pack and I'm like, you son of a 10 pounds lighter than I was.
I was
a little bit lighter than you. I'm gonna admit that.
That's funny.
So
but prior to that, Mr. Lenny,
which part are you talking about here, Steve? Yeah, so I had, I probably had 100. I think you maybe had 110. I don't know how, you know, our packs are just heavy leaving camp every day. Steven will be like, God, what do you got? You know, but you got bear spray and handguns and dry bags and extra this and extra that. It was hip just waders. Heavy. Hip waders strapped you there, your bow. And so we go back to go across the river going back, and Steve is out in front of me because he was going to film me coming back across, and he's going across there, and I saw it got to where the water was kind of coming in the top of his waders. I was like, man, that looks pretty, it was pretty intense.
I was telling somebody, like, if this was crossing the Boise River at home, it would be like not an issue at all. But when you're in the Arctic and you're 3 miles from your camp and you're thigh deep in a river that's freezing cold and there's 20, 30 mile an hour winds, it's like, if you fall in that river, you know, it's going to get like, it's kind of scary. So I make it across and the waders flooding, and then I turn around and film Lenny coming across.
Yeah. So yeah, he turns around, films me going across, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to go up here a little bit. And you know, it's a lot of weight in your back trying to cross this rocky, slippery, you know, river.
I guess you guys were like using poles to stabilize.
Yep. We had trekking poles to stabilize. There's no way you could have done it without them.
Right.
And I literally get like 10 feet from the bank, and Steve's like, watch out, it's kind of slippery right there. And I kind of look up and just wham, just freaking fell flat on my face right in the middle of the river with 100 pounds on my back.
Did you catch that on film too, Steve?
Oh, no, literally got it on film, man.
Like the second slippery comes out of your mouth, I kind of lift up my head and it's like, boosh, freaking fell.
I don't care what you guys do with like the real footage and story. I just want like the clips of Lenny sprinting, falling, and all that.
As I was coming across, it was like totally not slippery at all. And then the last like 10 feet of the bank, just kind of like this mossy rock. As Lenny got close, you couldn't have timed it any freaking better comically wise. Cause I'm just, you hear me on the camera go, it's a little slippery, and just bam, just right on his ass, falls back. I mean, water's rushing in his waders and pack and meat's in the river. And
oh yeah, my pack's on the slip. Oh yeah, my bow's on the back and horns on there.
Oh man.
I mean, it was a good damn thing I was so close to the edge as I was. If I was out in the middle with my waders full, I mean, that could have been really ugly. That would have been the point where I would have popped my pack off and we would have had to figure out what to do from there.
Yeah.
But so I did kind of screw Steve's hunt up, because the plan was we're going to cross the river, get back on this little knoll, and just wait until dark and hope another bull came in that same spot, because they seemed to be hitting there real good. But I was covered in water and freezing, so.
Yeah. Luckily, we had extra rain gear and extra, we were on that. It was just, the wind was so, you know, cut to the bone. We had every single article of clothing we had with us. So rain gear and long johns and freaking, you know, puffy jackets and all sorts of crap. So we had spares in the pack and ended up not being an issue. Although for the first 10 minutes, I was freaking out because I wasn't sure where Lenny was. Like, you know, he kind of is a tough bastard sometimes. And I wasn't sure if he was being, you know, like just trying to tough it out, and he was really like about ready to go hypothermia on me or what. What freaked me out is we started hiking, and like 5 minutes into the hike, he's just like, man, I'm sweating like crazy and I want to take my jacket off. And I think I've heard when you have hypothermia that you have the urge to take your clothes off. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions on the way back. Hey, Lenny, how old are you? What's your birthday? Like just random stuff, just making sure that his mind was still good. But end up, you know, Lenny went through it, I didn't, but ended up not being an issue. So
yeah, I mean, 100 pounds in your back, hiking back for 3.5 miles kept me pretty warm.
It'll warm me up, yeah.
Yeah.
So he screwed my hunt up for the afternoon.
So we hiked all the way back. We made it through the second river. That one was much easier. And, put the meat like 100 yards downwind at camp and said, all right, that's the end of it, right?
Yeah. And then a few hours later, LaFonda showed up.
Oh, yeah. LaFonda?
LaFonda was a very large, very dark colored grizzly bear right next to camp.
Oh, man.
So we're literally sitting there and just like, you know, it was probably a couple hours after we got back. We ate and I look up on the hill and I see a really dark spot. You know, it's just like, it's probably 800 yards from camp, but close enough. Like, huh.
Yeah, you can see it with your eye.
pull up the binos and, oh, that's a freaking grizzly bear. Because all the other grizzly bears we'd seen had all been like 3 miles south, you know. And here we are, like, you know, blood on our pants and jackets and meat in camp. And, you know, we're not experienced with grizzly bears at all. It's the first time we'd ever seen them in person. And you're just kind of going, huh, oh, crap. Well, I hope that's not an issue. so that was kind of fun.
Yeah, that was. But it was cool watching her, actually. I mean, like, she would, we think she was like a pregnant sow, like had this super like low hanging belly on her. I mean, not that we know that much about grizzlies. And then she would like lean up against this rock and scratch her back, and she'd like lay flat on her stomach and just like eat blueberries while she's just laying on her stomach. And so, you know, it was nerve wracking, but it's also, it was amazing to watch.
Yeah, that would be cool, as long as they stayed the distance.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so that was awesome. And then at some point, one of us looked like south from camp and like, oh, crap, there's caribou right there. And, you know, they're like a mile away. Pull up the binos. Oh, crap, there's a small bull in that group. And we'd kind of, I think it was like coming back Friday night, we had went a different route just to scout the kind of river that was right next to camp. We had kind of we'd cross the river and skirted through some different country trying to avoid like the really nasty tundra stuff. Which tundra stuff was crazy. Everyone has described to it as like walking on like the guide service or the transport service called it like walking on frozen footballs. And it was like, it was like walking on basketballs that were spaced like, I don't know, every 2 feet, 3 feet apart. So you'd have like this, you know, clump of dirt basically that stood like a foot and a half up. And then all around that would be basically like, if you missed stepping on a clump, you would drop down a foot and a half. And then you'd like, you basically tried to like jump from clump to clump, or sometimes it would just be easier to like kind of walk in the bottom of it. But the grass was kind of so thick that you can't really tell what's what. And so sometimes you'd step into one of those and it'd be freaking like ankle deep water. And, it was definitely, you know, it's a no joke. Like, that's not easy stuff to hike across. I don't envy people that have to do that a lot.
Yeah, sounds pretty brutal.
Yeah. But anyways, walking back from camp Friday night, we thought Saturday we were just going to kind of stay over there. And so we took a different route, which, you know, it was the harder route to take. But we wanted to scout that river. And when we did that, we actually figured like we were looking for trails and found out like, well, there's some trails right here. That looks like where they cross, because everywhere else is pretty kind of cliffy. And so once we saw this caribou there, we basically knew like, oh, they're going to cross right there. And so we like took off from camp. I, you know, I was just wearing like, you know, just our camp clothes and have, anything, just a puffy jacket on, and, grabbed the gun. We just went and grabbed the camera and we just like ran across the tundra, got to this little edge, hiked down the edge. And again, you know, freaking a lot of it's, hard work, and then a lot of times it just comes down to luck. Just like Lenny's, they'd crossed the river and then started feeding directly towards us, and so we just popped over the ridge and bam, there they were at 200 yards, and dropped down on my hands and knees with the pack, crawled forward, and took a couple minutes to, you know, I was laying flat and there's kind of a little bit of a rise in the hill, and wait for that bull to give me a shot, and wham, hammered him. He ran like 30-40 yards, and then I shot him again, and then he did the little circle thing and then fell down, and it was just like, holy crap, like 2 hours light left last day. I couldn't believe that we just pulled off getting two bulls down on the last day. It was pretty freaking awesome. Had some good high fives and got them cut up and back to camp, and literally woke up in the morning and we were getting picked up. It was pretty cool for everything to come together, like, you know, two bulls last day. It was fun. And Lenny and I just, in general, I think we just had such a good time on this hunt. You know, we had the adversity, we had delays getting in the field, we had terrible weather. I mean, both of our faces, I think mine finally stopped burning today. They were just like dry and chapped and peeling. And I mean, that wind just freaking took it out of you. But I think we did a good job keeping a positive attitude, because it had been really easy to get down and be like, this sucks, I'm never going to do it again. And but ultimately, you know, we're like, man, we're not in the office. We're up in the above the Arctic Circle in the Brooks Range. Let's just enjoy this and have as much fun as we can.
Yeah. Dang. That's super cool. Yeah. What a great way to end the trip.
Yeah, it was awesome.
The hunt, I guess. The trip wasn't over, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of guys always want to hear about, we talked a bit about with some of the Moose stuff and what you would have done different with that. So kind of hit the logistics a bit on getting the meat home, getting the rack home. Mm-hmm. What approach did you take with that?
Our transport service again was awesome. Once we got back to the airport, we literally show up. They have got a table. They've got meat boxes ready for you, and they've got a box for your antlers. So, I mean, made it super easy. We literally sat there, basically boned out our meat. So we gave basically half of it to the locals, and we kept half of it, boned it out, put it in a box. And then they already had a box ready for the antlers. So, and then they had, you got to cover the tips for the airport. And they also had big bags because there's some requirements at the airport, how you bag it, covered all the antlers in cardboard so they don't poke through, and then, wrap the head, basically double wrap the head so it doesn't leak anywhere. And it went from being impossible last time with the moose is what I felt like to being honestly like, super easy.
It was like an hour and we were done. Yeah. So the one thing, which we learned on the first trip and, you know, what, for whatever reason, they told us you couldn't do it, but you could very easily do it. You just get fish boxes. Guys, people use them all the time. Our, transport service, they just went and bought some themselves and sold them to you for like 10 or 20 bucks. Yeah, I think you can get them from Alaska Airlines as well. And then, yeah, you just got giant, you know, pretty heavy duty plastic bag, threw the meat in there. The hotel we stayed at actually had a walk-in freezer. So we took that box that probably weighed, I don't know, 75, 80 pounds, went and put it in the hotel's freezer, checked it in next morning on our flight or way to the airport. We grabbed the box, checked it into the luggage, and bam, you just flew, you know, 80 pounds of meat home for 50 bucks. It's what, you know, or no, $75 is what Alaska Airlines charged for that heavy bag. And then the antlers is the thing that tripped me out. So the box for the antlers is freaking huge. Like, I don't know, 40 inches by 40 inches by 20 inches tall is how Lenny's laid in there. And it only cost $100 to ship that home, just checking on his luggage. Yeah. It was freaking crazy. So much. I mean, hands down, the best way to go. I mean, I think you'd have to kill a giant caribou or giant moose to not fit it in a box like that. And mm-hmm. I don't know what the size restriction is. But yeah, even if you got to saw the skull plate in half and glue that back together,
if you split it, you could probably fit it in that box still, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Totally. Hands down, best way to go. You just do that. Bam, it's home. Last time we, you know, sent meat, from Bethel when it went to Anchorage and then sat at some processor, and we did the hunt in September and the meat never showed up to Boise until like sometime in January. It was a pain in the ass. Communication was terrible. It cost a ton of money. This was just way, way easier to go. And it was cool cause we got to donate, you know, I kind of have a half tough time doing that cause I, you know, shot a caribou to bring meat home. Yeah. So I brought home half of it, and then it was cool to donate the other half cause, you know, our transport service, the lady there just called up some resident and said, hey, do you want some caribou meat? And they're super excited to get it and they're going to eat it right away. You know, it's not going to waste. Mm-hmm. So the part was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so I definitely say check with whatever service you're working with and ask them very specifically, you know, how do you handle the meat? Because because last time we basically got charged for them then to transport it to the meat cutting, and then we got charged high rates to cut the meat, and then we got charged again to ship the meat home. So this was so much easier.
Yeah. Dang.
Yeah.
And, you know, not only was it cheaper and easier, but you have it right away. I mean, there's just no downside to it, you know?
Yep.
Yep.
That's awesome.
It was just a little preparation on the transporter guide service. That's all it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you take it, you know, it took us in. We got fairly decent experience boning out an animal because we do it in the field, and to just sit there and have a table in front of you and cut it up, you know, it takes an hour at tops and you're done.
Yeah. It's really easy when you're sitting there with the table and not on a freaking mountainside.
Totally. Yeah.
So, yeah. Other than that, things we do different, you know, I don't know. I think the big one probably for us is just because we went a little early and experienced the slow migration, I think, and low bull to cow ratio. I think we'd want to go back middle of September, which, you know, we intentionally went early so we could, you know, be back in Idaho for elk hunting, you know, September 1st. But, you know, to do it again, I think we'd go later in September and forego some elk hunting, unfortunately. There's just no way around it. And you'd probably have a better hunt. You'd probably run into more weather, which weather alone was brutal, but I think it'd be worth it for the better hunting.
Yeah. And make it a longer hunt.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, those two things. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Then, so I'm sure we could, you know, spend a whole chunk of time talking about the whole gear list, but highlight some things that stood out as working well, some things maybe that you didn't have that you wish you would have, kind of anything that sticks out in terms of gear for the positive or negative.
We used our spotting scopes much, much more than we ever anticipated.
Yeah.
We were behind the glass for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, that's one. Like Lenny had asked me, because I had that new Kawa 55, and I was like, that's good, that's plenty. You know, I'll just pack that. It's lightweight. You know, we're good. And then he's like, you sure? You know, maybe I'll bring my Sworo. And then he ended up bringing it, and it was hands down, we glassed a lot. I mean, probably, I'd say 80 to 90% of the day, all we did was sit and glass, and it's kind of. That's what you're doing, though. You're just glassing the country, waiting for something to come. So if they're not right in front of you, you're glassing. That was a huge, huge part of it. Something I never anticipated. I thought they'd be close. You'd see them at the binos. You'd run, get in place, and it was completely different.
Yeah, and then not the first time, but I got a pair of Crispy boots this year. I've had some issues with waterproofness on my Solomons, and I tell you, that was really nice to have like a truly waterproof boot because you're wet a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those interfaced fine with the hip waders and everything?
Yep. Worked perfect.
Sweet. What about clothing? You guys said you were bundled up pretty good with the wind chill and everything like that. I know you probably didn't have too much new, kind of running the same first light kit for the most part, but anything you added to that for these conditions?
No, yeah, it was just long, you know, just we literally just to cut the wind, because the temperatures were, like I said, 30 to 45 on the best day, but then, you know, on our DeLorme inreaches, you can get a weather forecast, and so it'd say like actual 33 feels like 19 degrees, and then I think you had the wind chill on top of that. So it was freaking cold, and with that wind, it just cut through everything. So we'd put on every layer we had, plus our rain gear on top of that, just to cut through that, to block the wind. And as long as we did that, and then we'd just hunker down in little, you know, kind of places on the south side of stuff, behind a little hill, behind a rock, whatever we could find, just to get out of the wind sometimes, because it was freaking brutal.
So for me, it's basically I had the Lano, Chama, and then I brought an extra kind of like insulated kind of a puffy jacket, like just one I run around town with, but I wore that all the time, and then my puffy on top of that, and then my rain gear on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of look like snowmen walking around out there.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Matching snowmen, of course.
Yeah, which that was usually enough, that many.
So if you take out if you take out some of the extremes or some of the lessons learned, some of the rookie mistakes from last year, what I'm getting at is what advice would you have? How would you compare the hunts just in general on like going caribou versus moose for somebody who wants to maybe go on their first trip up to Alaska? Again, not talking about the specifics of, you know, what you experienced, but overall, now that you've experienced both, what's kind of your feeling on what somebody might go for, based on what they're looking at? Or, I mean, what would you do again if you were just know what you know now and you're going the first time? Obviously, now that you know what you know, there's a lot that you would do different, right? But in terms of choosing the species, what would you choose?
Hands down, caribou first. And a couple of reasons for that. The main one just being it's a cheaper hunt. And so you're going to make all the rookie mistakes on gear and decisions and getting meat home and stuff like that. If you're like us and idiots and don't research in advance, you're going to make those on that first trip. And then when you do the more expensive moose hunt, just from a purely financial standpoint, you're making less mistakes and you're going to have a better experience for your money invested in that trip. And then, you know, frankly, for us, caribou hunting was much more our style of hunting. It was active. at least in the sense of, you know, it's like our mule deer hunts where we get up and we could spend an entire day glassing. And then once you spot something, it's pretty, you know, can be pretty aggressive of getting in place and getting a shot off. And the moose hunting was, you know, call from we still think your best chance to kill that moose in that country that we're hunting was just call from one, just stay in camp, walk 100 yards from camp, call and do that for 5 days. And because a moose will eventually just walk by, and there's not much else you could do in that country because you couldn't, you know, it was canoe and wade through knee deep muck. Maybe if you're up in the mountains, that'd have been different. We could move and go after stuff. But and then we just had a blast hunting them. I mean, it was just it was a cool thing for us. I think just, you know, it was a different species and learning new tactics on the fly, and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I think it definitely just kind of depends too on how you want to hunt, because this is, I think, a much more active hunt. You know, there's a lot of action, there's a lot of animals, and, you know, for us, that was kind of part of the experience versus, you know, a moose hunt is much slower. You're going to call in a lot less. It's just going to be a lot less action. And so hands down, I would do this 10 times over before I do a moose hunt.
Cool to hear, fellas. Excited. Thanks for sharing it. Excited to hear, you know, next time we get you guys back on the podcast, you're going to have some deer under your belt, some elk under your belt. It's mid-season. it's a cool time, man.
One thing I was going to say is I know there's a couple questions on gear we would take or gear we wouldn't take. And that's such a hard question to answer because I think Alaska can throw so much at you. I mean, I had extra stakes and rope and, you know, 4 days of extra food and all that stuff that we didn't need. And, you know, if we were hunting in Idaho, I'd check that off the list and be like, I'm never going to take that again. But I think if we did that exact same hunt tomorrow, we could have a completely different experience and we may need every single extra thing we brought. So, it's really tough to narrow that list down to like what I would bring and wouldn't bring on the next trip. Other than I think I want like full on, chest waders next time I do something.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Fellas, appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, so that's a wrap on this one, guys. I know that it's right in the middle of season. We want to hear from you. We want to see your field photos. If you're an EXO user, we want to hear how the pack is doing. If you're a podcast listener that maybe has gotten some value and put that knowledge into experience in the field this season, we want to hear about it. Be sure to reach out, podcasts@exomountaingear.com. We would love to hear about and see what you're up to. And as always, feedback's welcome, comments, questions, guest suggestions, all that are welcome. Hope your season is going great. Stay tuned for future episodes, including the big giveaway coming for number 100. All right, have fun, hunt hard, stay safe. We'll talk to you soon.